Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Good morning. This is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Nancy Solomon, managing editor for New Jersey Public Radio, sitting in for Brian, who is on a much-deserved vacation. It's Monday morning, and we always start with politics. Joining us now is Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine and an analyst for CNN. Good morning, Molly.
Good morning, Nancy.
So President Trump is expected to nominate a Supreme Court justice to replace the retiring Anthony Kennedy today. The announcement is scheduled for 9 o'clock tonight, and Trump indicated yesterday that he's got four judges on his shortlist.
I'm getting very close to making a final decision.
Not yet.
And I believe this person will do a great job.
So let's talk about the politics of this Supreme Court nomination. Yesterday, Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal told ABC his party is gearing up for a fight.
This next nominee will be the swing vote to overturn Roe v. Wade and, equally important, to eviscerate the protections for millions of Americans who suffer from pre-existing conditions and other health care rights, along with workers' rights, gay rights, voting rights.
So, Molly, what does it look like the Democrat strategy is going to be if it's a very conservative jurist, which is, of course, what's expected? Do they fight the court pick at all costs? And if so, how do they even do that?
Sure. Well, I think there's two things going on here. There's going to be sort of an inside game and an outside game. So when you say Democrats, on the one hand, you have the Democrats in the Senate, who are the ones who actually have a vote here, and there are some complicated considerations there. But then on the other hand, you have the outside game, Democrat, liberal, and other advocacy groups who are going to mount a pressure campaign on the outside, trying to convince senators, both Republican and Democrat, to vote against the pick. So, the Democrats in the Senate, not all of them have committed. Most of them have not committed. You certainly have liberals like Senator Blumenthal, who come from very blue states, who already can be pretty sure that any of at least the final four judges being considered would be conservatives. Senator Blumenthal referenced many of the potential issues that would be on the table here that a new conservative justice could swing the court in a different direction on all of those issues. But for the Democratic senators who are in purple or red states, they have to make a personal decision about the politics of this. Do they, try to... Several Democrats from red states, particularly Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, Joe Donnelly from Indiana, and Joe Manchin from West Virginia, they all voted for Trump's previous Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, and they come from states that Trump overwhelmingly won, and they are up for re-election. So they're going to have to decide, and there will be pressure from them on them from the right to decide whether to support whoever is nominated. Most of them at this point saying that they're going to wait and see who it is. So I think, the announcements tonight, all the suspense is around the announcement, but it's really going to be what happens after that that determines where this goes.
I think we have tape of Senator Blumenthal again yesterday on ABC. I think he hints at that inside-outside game that you just mentioned.
The Republicans control the votes in the Senate, but we have the American people on our side. The vast majority of American people, shown by poll after poll, want Roe v. Wade to be preserved.
So it sounds like, the Democrats are hoping that there'll be some pressure applied to both, moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats who could go against the party on this.
That's right. And so the other two senators who are really going to be the focus, I mentioned three Democrats who are going to get a lot of pressure to support the nominee. from the right. The Republican senators, who you'll see a lot of scrutiny, a lot of pressure on, are two moderate Republicans who support abortion rights, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine. Both of them are going to have a very tough decision to make, too, given that, you know, it's unlikely that the potential justice in question, the nominee, will have a stated commitment to overturn Roe v. Wade. But as Senator Blumenthal said there, it is widely assumed that that is the end game for a lot of social conservatives. And President Trump and his political advisors believe that the reason he won the 2016 election was because he put out a list of conservative Supreme Court justices, from which he is still picking. And that made conservative Republicans, and particularly social conservatives who were uneasy with some aspects of his persona or his platform, they were able to support him because they felt that that issue of the court was so important. So for Republicans, this is sort of the point of the Trump presidency. A lot of Republicans who are otherwise uneasy with Trump feel that it's all been worth it because of Gorsuch being on the court. And so if another conservative can be put on the court, I think that'll give a lot of Republicans reason to celebrate. Similarly, you hear a lot of anguish from Democrats about the lasting effect of this potential court pick and all of the issues that could swing in another direction now that I don't know if you could call Kennedy a moderate, but he was idiosyncratic, and that was what made him a swing vote. The final four justices Trump is considering thought to be much more solidly conservative.
Listeners, what questions do you have for Molly Ball about national politics and the politics of the Supreme Court nomination that will be announced by President Trump tonight? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Now, Molly, you were saying a moment ago about, you know, how important Supreme Court justice picks are to conservatives in the country. And I read a piece over the weekend about the fact that it is much more of a driving force for Republican voters than it is for Democratic voters. But I wonder if we're in a different moment now, and that the past really can't inform us on what we might see from Democratic voters, from the pressure that might be applied to senators across the whole political spectrum on this. Do you think things are different?
I think that's an excellent point, and it's something I've been thinking about as well, because, yes, in the past we've seen Republicans strongly motivated by Supreme Court picks, but you have absolutely seen a groundswell of liberal anger, anguish, and concern in the wake of this seat opening up, in the wake of Justice Kennedy's resignation, because they are sort of suddenly waking up to the realization of how many issues are potentially on the line if the court swings decidedly to the right. So, you know, ever since Trump was elected, I feel like the dominant political dynamic in this country has been this rising tide of liberal anger, the protests in the streets and the new organizations and activism and the turnout that we've seen in the elections that have happened since 2016. And so I would not be surprised if this Supreme Court nominee is as much of a galvanizer on the left as on the right for a population on the left that's already quite anguished about the Trump presidency, quite activated, and we've seen already very motivated. I think this is going to supercharge that feeling.
The New York Times wrote over the weekend that the pick could not come at a worse time for Democrats. A final confirmation vote will probably be called just weeks before a primary midterm election in which Democrats are defending a bunch of battleground states, 10 states that were carried by President Trump. A failure to hang on, the New York Times writes, to nearly all of those 10 would make a Senate takeover in the midterm elections very difficult. This is what Republican Senator Lindsey Graham hinted at yesterday on Fox News.
Maybe a handful of Democrats will vote for a Trump pick because they have to politically. I've never seen it this dysfunctional. There's nobody that President Trump could nominate from a conservative vent that will get many Democratic votes, but this is a nightmare for red state Democrats.
And I think, you know, specifically, there's been a lot of talk about anti-abortion Democrats in the Senate, Joe Manchin in West Virginia and Joe Donnelly of India. They both voted for Neil Gorsuch. So let's talk about that. What kind of political calculations are conservative Democrats facing?
It's a very tough one. I think Senator Graham is right about that. They are really going to be squeezed on this because the Senate dynamic has changed since Gorsuch was nominated. Republicans now have only 51 seats since the election of Doug Jones in Alabama, who is also a moderate to conservative Democrat who's going to have to decide where he falls on this. And so because of that narrow majority and because Republicans eliminated the filibuster for judicial, including Supreme Court nominees, Republicans need those 51 votes, and so they can't lose any of their own unless they get some Democrat senators to go the other way. So those, and as you mentioned, there are 10 Democrats in the Senate who come from states that Trump won in 2016, some of them by overwhelming margins. And so they are really going to be under pressure on an issue that, as we've discussed, is very motivating for red state voters, for Republican voters. People like Bob Casey in Pennsylvania may not be as worried because although Pennsylvania went blue in 2016, it's not so clear that went red in 2016. People don't necessarily feel that it's a permanent red state. But a state like Montana, a state like North Dakota, those voters are Republicans, and they're going to be watching their senator to see if this person demonstrates independence or demonstrates commitment to their national party. And as we've also discussed, there will be so much countervailing pressure from the left who feel that this is such a, you know, moment of generational importance because these justices can potentially serve for such a long time. These senators in the middle, the moderate Democrats and the moderate Republicans, are the deciding factor here. We really do not know which way this is going to go, and so it's going to be very intense.
Well, we have lots of callers on the line who'd like to ask questions, so let's go to Luit in Manhattan. Hi, Luit, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question. I'd like to know the legal answer to this. If a president is actually under potential criminal investigation, whether we're talking about the current Russia investigation or possible Emoluments Clause issues or even a possible issue about the separation of 2,000 to 4,000 children from asylum-seeking immigrants, if a president is under potential legal investigation, does he have the right to name a Supreme Court justice? Why can't this be put on hold until all criminal investigations under this man, for this man, are finished?
I haven't heard the Emoluments Clause brought up in a few months. Touché. Molly, what do you have to say?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but as far as I understand, the answer to that question on legal grounds is yes, he still has the right. Now, the debate around this, though, and this is a talking point that you're increasingly hearing from Democrats, the debate about this really centers not on the idea that there is some legal technicality, but on the idea of inventing a new procedural standard, because that's what they feel Republicans did when they stalled the nomination of Merrick Garland in 2016. I'm sure your listeners recall that in 2016, when a vacant seat came open on the Supreme Court and President Obama nominated Merrick Garland, the Republicans, rather than go through the motions, the Republican-led Senate simply refused to even hold a single hearing to consider this nominee. And so when Trump then became president, it became his nomination to fill, and that was the nomination that Neil Gorsuch ended up getting. Democrats are still quite raw about this. They feel that McConnell had no grounds to do this. He just simply decided to obstruct by making up a new rule about nominations in election years, which is not something that's in the Constitution or has even been a widespread tradition, but it was a new procedural standard that was invented. And so Democrats are now saying, okay, why don't we invent our own new procedural standard and we decree that a president who's under investigation can't can't hold, get hearings. The problem with that is the Democrats aren't in charge of the Senate, and it's the party in charge of the Senate that makes the rules. So I don't think there's any doubt that whoever Trump nominates will get a hearing, and then the question is just whether the Republicans who control the Senate have the votes.
Louis, thanks for your call. You know, I read an op-ed over the weekend that making the argument that the Democrats are to blame for the situation they find themselves in now, going back to the presidency of George W. Bush. There are tactical moves that they've made that now leave them with very little power, you know, not electorally, but in terms of the Supreme Court nomination process. Is that something that you're aware of, sort of missteps that the Democrats have made?
I'm not sure what specific missteps. I don't know the piece in question, so I'm not sure. I mean, the history of Supreme Court nominations is a tortured one, and it is, you know, going back to, say, Robert Bork, who's thought to be the first justice who was nominated by a Republican president and defeated by Democrats, he's sort of seen as a milestone for having been defeated primarily for ideological reasons rather than because of some disqualifying personal history. And so that, according to some critics of the Democrats, that was what opened the floodgates to this increasingly over the years, gradually but increasingly partisan judicial nominating process where, you know, the Constitution says the Senate gives advice and consent. And in the past, that really just meant they sort of made sure that this person could sit up straight and had a law degree. And it's turned more and more into an ideological vetting because more and more of the big issues that are coming to the court are decided along partisan lines. And so where in the past you saw Republican presidents nominate justices who turned out not to be particularly conservative, like Sandra Day O'Connor or Anthony Kennedy, increasingly there is a desire on both sides for justices who will be reliable votes on these litmus test issues.
I'm Nancy Solomon, managing editor for New Jersey Public Radio, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine and an analyst for CNN. Listeners, we're taking your calls. What would you like to ask about the Supreme Court nomination process, about the politics, or about anything about national politics? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And now we'll take another question from Ernest in Orange, New Jersey. Hi, Ernest. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Good. What's your question?
My whole objection to all of this is a justice supposed to be a justice, dealing with the facts and merits of each and every situation. How is it now we've got this situation, we caught up in this situation where we've got conservatives and progressive justices? That should never, ever be the case once we say a justice. And why is it that we've got to have a justice for life? The third situation is how it is, if we're such a democratic country, how it is that the popular vote did not present the president? We're going over all over the world killing people for democracy and telling them our way is the way. And we don't elect our president democratically. One man, one vote, majority wins.
Okay, well, let's start with question number one. How is it that this process has become so political and that we're not just as a country looking for the best legal minds, but legal minds that fit a certain set of politics? Molly?
Yeah, I'll sort of take them in reverse order, actually. I mean, the answer to all of these questions is the Constitution. The Electoral College is in the Constitution. The lifetime appointments for Supreme Court justices is in the Constitution. And the Constitution is an old and tricky and sometimes vague document that can be interpreted in different ways. And as we talked about before, there are different ideological outcomes that the parties would like to see on these issues that are important to them. And because we have a precedent-based system, we've now had hundreds of years of looking to the court as part of our system, our tripartite system of checks and balances, looking to the court to make constitutional interpretations on these tricky and quite polarizing issues. Now, there are plenty of things that the court does that doesn't affect these types of issues. The Supreme Court also decides a lot of cases regarding, you know, laws that pertain to business or administrative regulations, and sometimes those cases are indeed unanimous. But of course, our attention is focused on the cases in which the court is divided and the cases in which America is divided, because they hit these hot button issues like abortion or you know, workers' rights and so many other things. So yes, I think many people in the abstract would like to see a court that they feel is neutral, that, you know, in the parlance of so many previous nominees, simply calls balls and strikes and decides cases based on the merits. But in practice, what the Supreme Court does decides how the Constitution is interpreted at every level, and these are really tough issues for which there is no clear answer, and partisans very badly want the court to come out in on the side that they prefer.
Later in the show, we'll talk with Jamie Floyd about the specific members of this list, of the judges on the list, and you know, where they shake down. But I'm curious, Molly, what you see as the divide currently among Republicans on this nomination. You know, which camps are favoring whom, and why?
Yeah, you know, I have not honestly followed that particularly closely. Your other expert will probably be much better for that. But yes, you have different camps of Republicans saying, oh, you know, we want Kavanaugh, we want Kethledge, we're not sure, we think this person might be squishy, we think this person is better for whatever reason. I think that while that's true, that there is this internecine debate and squabbling and lobbying going on, and it should be said, we have no idea where the president's head is on this. It's actually quite remarkable that even people quite close to him believe that he either hasn't made up his mind or just isn't telling anyone because he likes the suspense, which is pretty surprising with less than 12 hours to go. But my point is that while there are different conservative camps lobbying for different members of this short list, I think Republicans broadly and conservatives broadly are going to be happy with any of these four potential nominees. They're all considered quite conservative. They all come from this list that was composed before the election with the help of the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society, quite conservative organizations. And so I don't think any of these four potential picks is going to really prompt an outcry on the right.
A lot has been said about the idea of precedent and, you know, whether or not a nominee is going to respect precedent such as Roe v. Wade or whether they want to overturn it. Are you seeing any kind of differences or sort of nuanced differences among Republicans on that issue that Democrats might try to exploit?
Yes, we have heard the Republican potential swing votes invoke this idea of precedent. Precedent has simply become the code word for Roe v. Wade, because the allusion is they don't want to come out and say, you know, we want a nominee who's going to affirm Roe v. Wade. The idea is to dress it up in this idea of precedent. So when a senator says, I want judges that respect precedent, they're saying, I want a judge who's not going to overturn Roe v. Wade, which has been the law of the land for decades now. And when a senator says something the opposite of that, you know, they're saying that they want a judge who would overturn it. You have fewer senators saying that out loud, in part because there's not a lot of popular support for overturning Roe v. Wade, although it's quite popular among social conservatives, and in part because they do want to give the impression that this is a more neutral process, that it isn't like a vote in the Senate where you vote for or against the issue. But it is this matter of interpretation, and that is the key to how this justice potentially would rule.
Okay, let's take another call. Derek from the Upper West Side. Hi, Derek, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Basic point I want to make is cutting the line. Obama nominated a SCOTUS justice, and McConnell refused to schedule the appropriate interviews, and the Constitution says the Senate can advise consent. It doesn't say they can ignore, which is what they did, which led to Gorsuch getting in rather than Obama's nominee. Now, technically, Obama's nominee is still in the queue. Technically, he's never gotten his advising consent, which the Senate is required to do. So now that there's another opening, it's even though Gorsuch cut the line, you should let everybody else cut the line and continue this ignoring the Obama nominee. Add that to the fact that it's been reported, I think on Democracy Now! Last week, that Trump was courting Kennedy to retire even, I think they said even prior to Trump's election, and that their sons, Kennedy's son and Donnie Jr., have these business contacts seem almost intricate. But notwithstanding the fact that Trump seemed to have been planning Kennedy's retirement for his first pick, and he got caught, everybody got caught by surprise when I don't want to say Alito, but the guy, the justice who died unexpectedly. Anyway, my point is, they are not allowed to cut the line. The Obama's candidate is still there waiting for his interviews and his vote, and he should get it before anybody else, because otherwise they'd be cutting the line, which there's nothing in the Constitution that says they can do that, and there's no rule in the Senate that says they can do that.
Now, I thought that article in the Times about the way that the way that Trump and the Trump administration courted Kennedy so that he would feel comfortable retiring and leaving that pick to the president, I did find that really surprising and interesting. Molly, you want to respond to Derek?
Sure. I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that they can, but there's also nothing that says that they can't. And Merrick Garland has, in fact, is no longer in, there isn't a queue or a line for Supreme Court nominations, but he's gone back to his old job. He continues to be an appellate judge on the D.C. Circuit, and so that is not an active nomination, as just simply as a matter of fact, as much as some people might like it to be. Now, Senator Chuck Schumer, the leader of the Democratic minority, spoke to Trump last week and reportedly asked Trump to consider nominating Merrick Garland, which is, I don't think anybody expects that he'll do that, but it was sort of a, you might as well try if you're Schumer and say, hey, here's something you could do that people would like. I think if Trump did that, the Republicans in the Senate would not be happy, because they already prevented Garland from getting on the court once.
And of course, this is this in some ways is a much bigger pick than the Neil Gorsuch one, because it seems most certainly is going to tip the balance on the court. So, you know, we don't have a whole lot of time left, and I did want to talk about some other issues. Let's talk about the trade war with China. The Trump administration imposed a 25% tax on $34 billion worth of Chinese imports on Friday. China is retaliating with taxes on an equal amount of U.S. products, including soybeans, electric cars, and pork. The administration has penalized steel and aluminum imports from allies such as Canada and Mexico, leading to retaliation against American-made products such as blue jeans, motorcycles, and whiskey. So, what is Trump trying to achieve, and who are the winners and losers of this policy?
Well, Trump has always believed, dating back decades before his political career, that America is being taken advantage of by other countries and other economies, and that the trade deficit is evidence of this. Now, very few economists agree with him here. There's near unanimity that the system of free trade benefits everyone, and that the trade deficit is actually to our advantage, because we are getting goods from abroad that we value. Now, that has not dissuaded Trump, and he has basically spent the first year and a half of his presidency fighting with the conservative economic advisors who've tried to get him not to do this, and he's finally won. And so he's kicked off this quote-unquote trade war. We've just now seen the sort of opening skirmishes. And so it's as these tariffs begin to take effect that we're going to see where this is headed. Is it going to, you know, have some of the dire economic effects that have been predicted, either slowing down the overall economy or pinching people in the pocketbook by raising the price of goods that they care about? Is that going to lead to inflation or a political backlash? It also affects a lot of industries. It affects farmers. Are they going to bring some pressure to bear on the administration to rescind this? Or what if Trump turns out to be right in his, economically marginal macroeconomic theory, and in fact, what we get is a renaissance of American manufacturing, and a system, and all these countries come to the table and negotiate better trade deals on our terms, and that leads the American economy to be better off after a temporary period of pain. That's essentially the pitch that Trump is making, and the view that he holds.
It would seem to me, and I'm hardly an expert on this stuff, but it would seem to me that the benefits that are possible that you mentioned from the trade war would really take quite a long time to be, you know, to bear fruit, whereas we have the midterm election coming up in just a few months, and that seems to be a real game changer in terms of, you know, the middle of the country, the breadbasket, farmers, red states that, you know, people, I'm seeing reports, people are already really concerned about this. Do you see this as what could become a game changer with the midterm elections?
No, I mean, it could have some effect, but I think it'll probably take longer than that to take effect. We have a quite strong economy, a very, very strong economy. And so the other argument that you hear from the administration and its allies is that the job market is so tight right now. There are more jobs than there are people to fill them. And that becomes an economic problem at some point, of course, when industries can't fill their openings. But because the job market is so strong, they feel that any squeeze from a potential trade war is going to fall on this sort of cushion of economic success that we have, so that, you know, for this economy to soften a little bit would still be pretty good, and people aren't going to feel it, at least in the next few months. So it's certainly possible that we are plunged into a sudden recession. Most analysts, I think, expect the effects to be more gradual than that. But absolutely, Republicans in particular, who have historically been free traders, are terrified that this is going to basically erase what they believe are the economic gains of the Trump administration and its deregulation and tax cuts. And so you do have a lot of Republicans in and out of office lobbying very hard to get the president to ease up on the tariffs, on the trade war, and to stop doing this. I think because Trump believes so strongly in this, and because, frankly, he looks around and doesn't see the sky falling the way everybody said that it would, at least not yet, he's unlikely to unwind this unless, I think, he sees evidence it's really hurting him.
Let's take one more call. Marie in Manhattan. Hi, Marie, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. What I wanted to say is, in my heart of hearts, despite the viciousness, the divisiveness, everything that's going on in this country now, nothing lasts forever. And I will be long dead. You probably will be, and everyone who's alive now. However, in 2060, the minority becomes the majority. And at that point, whatever is now can be changed. People will wake up. If they overturn Roe versus Wade, they'll reinstate it, or they'll do it in a different form. I think we're going to outlive the trauma and the tragedy of today. That, at least, is my optimistic approach. And it's illustrated to me by the winning of the primary of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They were interviewing her on a TV program, and they said, "Did you have any inkling that you might win?" She said, "No, but on my way into the bowling alley where we had my party, I met two young boys who said, 'Hey, we just voted for you.'" And she said she asked them both how old they were, and they said 19. And she said, "I thought to myself, 19 in an off year, and they're out there voting in a primary, this is a sign of change and of things to come. And this happened in her neighborhood in the Bronx. So I do believe that in time, the minority majority will take over and shall rule this planet. And I hope my eternal soul is watching down with glee, because my body will long be gone.
Thanks, Marie. So let's talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, her victory, her primary victory over the incumbent Congressman Joe Crowley. What's being said in Washington? What are the ripple effects? You know, how is this being seen among Democrats?
Well, I think in two opposing ways. On the one hand, it's exciting, and on the other hand, it's scary. So if you are a Democratic member of Congress, you suddenly have to worry about your left flank and worry that someone, a fresh face with a message of change who can appeal to a more diverse electorate can capitalize on, all of that liberal motivation this year and topple a kingmaker. I mean, it's hard to overstate the power that Joe Crowley had, in the Queens Democratic machine, and yet he was resoundingly defeated. And so on the other hand, it's exciting for a lot of Democrats to see this grassroots groundswell, to see their voters so motivated, to see particularly lower-income voters and voters of color being motivated to come out in a primary. I think elected Democrats would prefer that the change not target them in particular, but they do like the idea that, as the caller said, there is a lot of people are very motivated, particularly on the left, to come out and vote, and that is Democrats hope that that is going to pay dividends for them in November in the general election rather than in these primaries. And the other thing I would say about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, another thing that people find very exciting about her is that she is such an effective messenger. She has really taken her victory and capitalized on it, run with it. She's used her national platform to boost other Democratic candidates and as a megaphone for her issues and stances and the things that she believes in. And Democrats are very excited to have someone like that on the scene who they feel is such an effective communicator for their point of view.
Well, that's a good spot to leave it. Molly Ball is the national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Thanks so much for joining us, Molly.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Solomon, filling in for Brian Lehrer. We'll be right back.